Accession number 30423, reel 2.
And the idea would be, in attacking a submarine, the hedgehog would be fired, and a pattern of 24 hedgehogs would go out and down and hopefully hit a submarine. At the same time, starboard, ports aft and aft complete, were rows of depth charges. That was the armament of the ship. Our HFDF aerial was like a four-pronged birdcage on top of the mast. And we would calibrate it while we climb up to the top and sit and calibrate it. We had a cabin on the deck immediately below the bridge, about 6 foot by 6 foot. Three of us were HFDF operators. Our job was to listen in to known submarine frequencies and hopefully to pick up and then take a bearing by the radar signal and plot it. Plotting it with other ships, so the cross bearings would be the origin of the submarine transmission. We left, the ship had just been built at Brown's Shipyard in Bristol. So this was our first maiden voyage. We went to Northern Ireland and Tobermory in Scotland, for trials, testing, calibrating, firing our guns. We were degaussed. Now, degaussing is to make the ship non-magnetic by placing a cable around it and then, I suppose, electrifying it to take away the magnetism to avoid the ship attracting acoustic mines or any torpedo, perhaps, that were attracted by metal. Went through all these operations. We passed and received our commission.
It was, which year was it that you joined?
That was in June of 1943.
If we just pause there and just go back a little bit, what was it that made you choose the Navy over... How did you choose the Navy over the Army or the Air Force?
I chose the Navy because, one, I've been brought up by the seaside. I'd been quite happy with the Army. I was not inclined to the RAF. But I think because being in a maritime area and I worked in the post office and I was hoping one day perhaps to be in the electrical side of the post office, and perhaps naively thought being a telegraphist and learning wireless would help me towards that aim. So I put that together. I thought it may help me in future years, but the Navy was my dream.
And when it came to being taught Morse,
yes,
how did the process work?
I have a Morse key now. I can do the same Morse as I could in those days. It has never left me. I could Morse it just as quick as I could write. Now, I think you sat and you studied and you learned day after day after day, practicing repetitive, until the letter A was da-da, and B was da-da-da. It became part of your mentality. The radio, the wireless side of it, was quite elementary. It was not scientific. It was what you would need to do using the equipment, not maintaining it. That was someone else's skill. So our job was how to use the equipment, how to read Morse, how to write it down quickly. Now, because of HSTF work, I was never involved in transmissions, which I can do. It was always in reception.
Would you be able to describe a little bit more about HMS Impregnable itself?
Impregnable was on the outskirts of Chimpurzo by a place called Bull Point. Bull Point was where the munitions were kept safely, partly underground or in bunkers, beside of that. Not a very healthy place to be if you were bombed, I suppose. It had a big parade ground. It had huts, all named after admirals, Collingwood, and so on, Nelson, and you belonged to a hut. I think I was in Collingwood. That was simply because that was there. By the big parade ground was a big drill hall where you would undertake PT, physical training, the parade ground, marching, drilling, rifle drill, and had a jetty for the boats for rowing. So really our day consisted of on a rare day of drill, we go to our classroom, study and practice Morse, day after day after day. Impregnable, at years gone by, I understand, had been a naval prison, a barracks, opposite side of the river, were some old hulks, ship hulks. Now they had also been prisons for naval personnel in many years gone by, and the hulks are still there. And I remember seeing those and fascinated by their history. After the war, the same place, Impregnable, became used for Wrens. It was a radio school for Wrens and then General Rennery. Near the parade ground was a very tall mast with a top on it and a platform. We all had to climb the rigging to get to the platform. Some would get on the top and be called a button boy. He stood on the top, we were a button boy. I got as far as a platform. That's enough for me. I suppose it was just a question of drill, discipline, no particular training learned from that, but just discipline. I had a couple of weekend leaves before being sent to Eastbourne. On one leave I came home and found my house, my home, had suffered severe bomb damage. A plane had obviously ran parallel with the railway line, but it dropped the bombs about 50 yards in from the line, and it struck behind my house and bounced right over the top, landed the other side about 75 yards away and exploded, shifting the roof of my house. And I came home. Again, my family did not leave the house. They stayed there. There was no decision to go away. I think, although, again I repeat, the war could have been demoralizing. It was not, because of the belief that we would survive and we would win. Again, I have no recollection of ever being frightened. I must have felt fear at times. I was brought up in a religious background, my father ran a Bible class. My mother was a superintendent of the girls' Sunday school. And I always carried a text right through the war. Yea, thou walk the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I've still got that. Now that's something I'd not thought of before. That is, yes. Yes, there must have been fear at times, but I don't remember ever being petrified or frightened. I think survival and the will to survive overcomes that. You put up with terrible things. In fact, later in my service, I did go through some rather hairy, perhaps horrific occasions, but you would survive. Can I stop there a second?
How did you find the adjustment to naval life at HMS Impregnable?
I enjoyed very much the life as a naval rating, possibly because I have been brought up in a disciplined environment with my family and at school, so it was easy for me to adapt to it. I've never suffered from lack of confidence. We've been very confident, so whatever happened there, that was it. I accepted it, and I probably it was accepting things and discipline that enabled me to say yes, I enjoyed being there very much. So I also think you believe that, you know, patriotism it seems to be looked down upon somehow, but I think in those days we were patriotic. We believed in our country. We believed that we were serving the nation, the king. It sounds a bit old-fashioned now to say that, but I think that was a lot to do with why people joined up, perhaps. But I found not everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. I can say I enjoyed it.
What were the relations like between the local population and the ratings?
The local population and...
And the ratings at Impregnable.
Yeah.
The ratings at Impregnable...
Between the local population. Plymouth had been severely bombed, and the population of Plymouth 100% pro the Royal Navy. If they could help you, they would. There was no antagonism. There was not a problem with drunkenness. There was not a problem with misbehavior. People were very correct. And I think the Navy respected the population for what they'd been through, and the population respected the Navy for what they were doing. But it's a naval city. There was Aggie Weston's canteen. Now, Aggie Weston is a slang name for a lady called, I think, Agatha Weston, who had money and has set up a canteen to serve food, and the sailors would all go there. Salvation Army, they did the same. And I think it was a thing called the British Restaurant, where you could go into town and you would always get a meal in Plymouth. It would be a basic meal, but you could get it without coupons. So our contact with the public really was only went into town from Pregnable for a drink or walk around. We would go to St. Budo. There was another church canteen there which served sandwiches and was run by a chaplain, I think, and they'd have dances. Now, our social life was really non-existent. You're either training or you already went home. Now, I can't remember going home very much. I do remember one weekend getting home and not getting back on time because the train had stopped at Totnes, that's between here and Plymouth, through an air raid. But if you had to be back at a certain time, you had to be back or you were under regulations. So life really at Impregnable was being trained. Nothing else. We would go out on the Hoe. That was a very popular place to go on Plymouth Hoe on a Sunday afternoon. Be full of sailors, Royal Marines, basically, doing nothing but walking around. I cannot think of any amusements. I don't think we saw went to cinemas, nothing like that.
Did many of the ratings have girlfriends or sweethearts at that stage?
In the camp were a few married men, but I would say the vast majority were young bachelors. Girlfriends, yes, to a limited extent. You may not get to know a wren. In fact, I did not see much contact between civilian females. And perhaps for two reasons. Most young civilian females would have their own boyfriends. Most of the females we met were in the services. But I don't think that figured greatly in our lives. I don't think the time and the opportunity, as I said, we were either training or went home. If you have a few hours off, it would only be a few hours off of an evening and you go to a canteen. So I think the social life was 10%.
What did you learn in the way of seamanship while Impregnable?
Yes, being telegraphist, seamanship was limited. I learned to row a whaler with probably 8 rowers. Became quite proficient at that. We learned knots. Again, of no use whatsoever to me as a telegraphist, but we learned knots. We did a limited amount of rifle drill. limited of flag waving, semaphore. And I suppose, again, apart from the elementary rowing knots, our seamanship would not pass muster. We were telegraphists. And I suppose that went for most trades. If you were a stoker, you were learning your engineering. If you're an electrician or an Aztec operator, that is what you did. In fact, everyone had their own skill and they did not really overlap. So my skill, being a telegraphist, was being a telegraphist. Seamanship was not in it. A sailor, an able seaman, yes, that would be his training. I'd be very skilled at it. But we were, even life on board ships, we were separate. Our mess, we consist of telegraphists, Aztec operators, electricians. Another mess would be stokers. We were in cliques, not cliques to be separate by fellowship or comradeship, but by trade or experience. I found that with HMS Ban, because 80% of the ship's company of 140 were HOs, hostilities only. We were amateur sailors. The other 20% would be regulars. They would be slightly older than most of us, 18, 22. The regulars would be with 22 above. But even they were not proficient in seamanship completely, because some had, before the war, had not had a chance to join the ship. So if you say another 10 to 12% were semi-amateurs, the ship really went to sea with a crew of landlubbers doing their own particular jobs. The captain was an ex-merchant naval officer, Captain Shaw. So when you look at it, you think of today's Navy with all the technology, they're all professional sailors. At the beginning of the war, no, we were not. We were people who learned a trade and could do what we had to do on that ship to make the ship go. Sometimes, not very efficient, but it went. That may seem a bit strange to talk of that way, but that's the reality of it.
How did the crew gel together to start with on the new ship?
Yes, despite our different trades or skills, the comradeship, I can only speak of the Ban, because my river class frigate, 140 people, were very different than perhaps a cruiser, where you would not get to know everyone. We were a family would be a right word. I do not know, in all the time I was on the ship, from 43 until the end of 44, that we ever had a fight, a disagreement, or a theft. None of those things happened. We were all different. Even when we went ashore, we would do different things, have different interests. But the comradeship was very, very strong. And I think it is because the unknown influence that we depended on each other for survival, that each person did his job correctly. When I laughed just now and said, sometimes we were not very clever, we would go into Casablanca the first thing our ship does is hit a buoy. Then we got a cable around our screw, around the propeller. Then we crashed alongside an American destroyer. But we were there. Some months later, we went into Mauritius, going into Port Louis, at about 10 knots. We hit the dock head on, had a dent in our bow. The captain blamed the number one, and Jimmy blamed the captain. Now, it may sound like a comedy, it's not. Accidents occurred, but on the other hand, when we had action stations, and we had plenty of that, I'll tell you in a moment some of the action stations, and they were quite well organized, disciplined, and effective. Because then you come into your own, you do what you are trained to do. So despite the comical side I just told you, that is not the whole. The whole is living together, being together. Now, our mess were very secluded. We were, to think of us, the stokers were stokers. We lived in hammocks. The petty officer or chief officer may have had a bunk. Officer had a bunk in a cabin. But that did not matter. We mixed together. Now, perhaps on a bigger ship, you would not find petty officers going ashore with ratings. But when we went ashore, we could go together. I might go ashore with a petty officer. A chief officer might go ashore with an officer. So there's not the division that you would find on the bigger ships. A small ship is so very different. They call it hard-lying. And we have benefits of being hard-lying. We did not have to dress at sea. I wore for years, for months, an old pair of blue shorts and sandals. Nothing else. Some of them were singlet. It's only when you entered the harbour or shore you put on your white uniform or sailor's uniform or blues. At sea, no. Now, I cannot see that happening on a cruiser or an aircraft carrier. Again, living in the ship, we did not have a caterer. We could not line up and get our food for the mess. We had what we call broadside catering. A mess, right, we have a forecastle. On one side of the forecastle was our group at 12 to 14, then a stanchion. On the other side, another group. Further up the ship, we had another group. Each group would get an allowance, financial allowance. Two of you for that week were responsible for the food. You would decide what you wanted. You would buy it from the canteen manager, a naffy man. You would come back, get it ready, take it to the galley. The cook would cook it for you in his galley. You would collect it, bring it back to our mess. You would sit around, you'd put up a trestle table and sit around and eat your food. Now, having said that, we did not go in for Sunday roasts and things like that. Pot mess was the most popular food. Tins of meat, tins of vegetables, potatoes, all put into a big fanny. Take it to the galley, who heat it through. You bring it back. It's a glorified stew called pot mess. Tea was in a big container,